Hi, this is Johnny. Our podcast is going to start in a second. First, let me do a little business. You can now hear How Did I Get Here on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly from your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, or Palm phones, on demand and on the go. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com or in your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Now that wasn't so bad, right?
And you may ask yourself,
did I get here? And now here is your host, Tommy Maldi. When we talked
all night. Hi there. I am Johnny. Welcome to my podcast. It's called How Did I Get Here? It's crazy. Today, my guests are Lori Singer and Bradley Kopp. I've known Bradley Kopp since I was like 14 years old. He used to take me around to his gigs and stuff, which I really appreciated when I was young, and I learned a lot from him. And then when I moved back to Austin in like 1991, I lived in the studio that he worked out of that we talk about there, the Congress House studio that was owned by my friend Mark Hallman and his friend as well. Anyway, I was really glad to get to have Lori and Brad over. I don't know Lori that well, but I got to know her a lot better. And without further ado, here is Lori Singer and Bradley Kopp. Enjoy.
Mama sure could spend Dad's money so fast, it wasn't funny. Poor Daddy just never knew about all the cash she went through. He's working hard to bring home the bacon. She's spending all the cash he's making. At the end of the day, the only thing that he can say is, oh no, where'd all the money go? Mama was a real homemaker. She had a chauffeur.
You have to tell me the truth that Daddy is a fictional character. There's not really this poor dude out there.
Yeah, there is.
Oh,
he's out there. Absolutely. And the weirdest part about it is he's very proud of that song.
Oh, really?
It's kind of redemption for him that song ever got written.
Yeah, we were a little nervous the first time we played it for him. We were doing an on-air interview and playing stuff on KPFT in Houston. Uh-huh. And Lori's dad and stepmom came with us, and he had never heard it before. The first time he heard it, we were singing.
Oh, it's about your dad.
Yes, my dad.
Oh, wow.
And my mom.
Oh, wow.
And that's my life.
That's why it's good.
Afterwards, Lori's dad, Howard, when we walked out of the little cutting room into the control room, he's looking at the DJ going, hey, yeah, that song, I'm the dad in that song. And he was...
Wow.
Yeah, was cool.
So did he put his stock at Enron too?
No, that part you made up. Just okay. Embellished a little.
All right.
Bit there.
Because I was listening to the song and I was like, I don't think I heard this story from Brad. So this didn't happen to him. Hopefully they just made up some poor guy, but he's your dad.
No, we had so much fun writing it. We laughed hysterically for about 2.5 hours.
Well, it's really funny. It has a good, you made lemons out of lemonade, or made lemonade out of lemons.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
You created lemons.
Well, and Howard had told us, he had, you know, basically said, you know, well, Lori's mom thought as long as there were checks in the checkbook, there was money in the bank.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That's a misconception people have.
Back then, maybe.
Yeah.
Housewives.
Yeah.
Didn't know where the money came from.
Yeah. So I'm in my apartment with Lori Singer and Bradley Kopp, my friends. They are my guests today. They have a new album called A Deep Oasis, and that's from that album.
Yeah.
Yes.
How many? It's a full length album.
13 songs.
Nice. You weren't superstitious about it.
Mm-mm.
No. Superstitious? What's that?
I don't know. It's a Stevie Wonder song.
Oh yeah. That's yeah.
So this is your second album?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And your first one, what was that? Walk Tall?
Walk Tall, we did that we released that in 2005. And we just wanted to make a record, and we were doing a lot of other things at the time, and I was playing with a bunch of other people and making records for a bunch of other people, and Lori was singing with a bunch of other people, and so we didn't really write for that record. But what we did was we contacted friends, you know, successful singer-songwriter friends, and got material from them, and that's how we put together the first record.
Okay, well, that's cool.
We'd never written anything together either before. Right. And decided right after that to start writing together.
Yeah? How is that? I mean, how's that being... you're married.
It was great.
And you work together.
Right, Brad? It was
great.
Yeah,
it was just fabulous.
Yeah. And your studio's in your house, too, so, like, there's no escape from anything
exactly.
In this place.
Yeah, exactly. I can't get away.
Imagine that the level of resentment outside of just a normal resentment in a marriage just, like, it goes exponentially.
There was a little rough spot in there somewhere.
I'm sure.
To find common ground for working together because both of us had lots of experience, but not together.
Right.
And had our own way of doing things.
Yeah, right. Our processes are definitely different. Mine's real linear, and Lori's isn't. Lori can, she can write, you know, 20 verses to a song and, you know, and bring it to me. And to me, it's like, is this music? This is an editing project.
Right.
Whereas... for her, it's, you know, that she can compartmentalize all of that. And me, I need to start at beat one of the song,
right,
and go to the end.
So it works. You guys kind of like, work, play off each other's strengths,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And
most
of the
each
time.
Other's weaknesses. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you were talking about your family, and I was reading your bio, Lori, and it is the beginning of it was just so odd. You had an odd upbringing.
Oh, in what way?
You came from theater people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Well, theater mom.
Theater mom. And what did your dad do? What was his? He obviously was out there working.
He was working his ass off. Just trying to keep the home fires burning.
Yeah, I'm sure.
No, he was a builder. And he was a Navy guy who got a football scholarship to Duke. And ended up after he got out of the Navy... I forget the order of things. He went to Yale, graduated mm-hmm. from Yale, and got a degree in engineering and started applying for jobs around the country. And someone down in Houston was working on building the Shamrock Hotel.
Oh, wow.
And called him up and
asked. Which is now Hotel Zaza, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, yeah.
Back then, though, this was the late 40s, he picked and chose between a few options and decided to go down to Houston. And helped in that. He's got great stories. A lot of times we'll be driving in the car and I'll have my phone with me, you know, and he'll start talking and I'll say, and I'll just be fumbling with the phone to get the voice recorder going.
Yeah,
Dad, what was that again? Who was that? Glenn McCarthy? Who was that other person?
Right.
And he'll tell me stories about people back then in Houston, just kind of like the movie Giant.
Yeah.
You know, his version.
Yeah, yeah.
His part in it. And sure enough, he met the boss's daughter down in Houston, and she said she took one look at him and knew, I'm going to marry that guy.
That was your mom?
I don't think he had, you know, he had choice in it.
Right.
Yeah, that was my mom. And she was an artist, but a real intellectual too, and was real hard to, it was hard to keep her still. She got her hands in just about everything in the arts, acting, singing, writing, producing. She produced a gold medal award-winning film. And just kind of was a snowball that way.
Right, right.
Just kept getting into one area of it after another. But really not much in the way of homemaker.
Right.
Or, you know, yeah. Getting the groceries, going to the
right.
PTA meetings. And
yeah, she could take you to a fabulous party after a play at the Alley, but not a...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that must have been... And then she left your dad and you guys moved to California?
That's a whole another movie there.
Right. So when did you start getting involved in music?
Probably 5-6 years old, I guess. Yeah. I was always singing around the house and watching her on TV. We had a little TV in the house and I remember one morning.
What show was she on?
She was on a, what show was it? She was singing. She, we all sat down around the kitchen table and had a little TV in there, and we were all real quiet. And your mom's going to be on any second now. And sure enough, there she was on TV singing something. And I don't know what show
she it was. Like Don Mahoney and Gina Clare or something like that?
It was something where there was just some local show, and she was asked to go on, maybe to promote whatever show was at the Alley Theater that she was going to be in. And
wow. That's cool. Yeah.
So it was just second nature.
Yeah.
It was just commonplace around the house. And if all of us went somewhere in the car, my two sisters and me and my dad and mom, we was always singing.
Yeah.
Show tunes mostly.
Yeah, because she was a theater person, right? Yeah. And you, were you in theater?
No.
No? Mm-mm. That's good. Yeah. That always makes weirder people. Theater people are always weird. Like, actors are too weird for me.
Yeah, they can be scary.
Yeah, unless they're normal.
When is that?
What that means. Well, I've met a couple of normal ones. They're like normal people. Like, just not that, like, and dramatic, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it seems like theater people are always dramatic. When I was reading that, I thought of your mom as kind of like a hyper-dramatic kind of,
she
like,
was a little on the flamboyant side. Bohemian, my dad liked to say.
Yeah. Yeah. And so was your family was musical too, right?
In absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. My mom was raised in the Texas Panhandle, in the same town that I was born and raised in. And
which was?
Wellington, Texas, 95 miles southeast of Amarillo, in the middle of freaking nowhere. And she and her twin sister, upon graduation from high school, moved to Lubbock, and I think they were at Texas Tech for maybe a year, and then they both went to New York to study voice. They studied opera under the tutelage of some teacher named Hazel Bennett. And sang in professionally in choirs, that kind of thing, as they studied and, you know, got jobs in New York. And my mom worked for Carl Fisher Music, violin sheet music or something, and was
in
there
New York,
in New York City. Yeah, and my dad was born in London, raised in Paris, and after the war, he grew up in Paris during the occupation. And came over from France after the war ended. He scraped up $50 and got on a boat and came over. And I think he, in fact, I know he did. He worked at Carl Fisher Music as well. And that's how they met. That's how they met.
How did they end up in Wellington?
Oh, this is great. My grandmother, my Texas grandmother, Marjorie, also known as Big Mom.
I love these names like Hazel and Marjorie. Where are these names now?
I don't know.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Somewhere out there. My grandmother wrote my mom's twin sister, Louise, and said, I need for you to come home and take care of me while I recuperate from this gallbladder operation I've got to have. Well, it was a total fabrication. There was no gallbladder operation.
She just wanted her to come home.
And my Aunt Louise didn't want to come home. And I think at that point, maybe Dad and Mom were between gigs or something. And they said, well, we'll go to Wellington for 3 months. Well, they ended up there for 24 years. Oof. And I'm the middle child. My brother was born there in 50. I think they got there probably 48 or 9.
Right.
George was born in 50. I was born in 53. And my sister was born in 61. So we ended up being raised there. And my mom taught voice and piano. And so we were all
did
around.
Did she do this out of the house?
Yeah. She did it out of the house. And we were all around music from the beginning.
Right.
I mean, from when I was in her belly, she was singing and, you know, and playing piano and teaching and all that. And she trained Teresa Treadway, who's from Hollis, Oklahoma, who went on to sing for the Met in New York.
Wow.
So, you know, we would have been drummed out of the family.
Yeah.
If we hadn't pursued
music in some way.
Music in some way.
So was it rock and roll that got you at first? Like, when did you want the guitar that they gave you?
Oh yeah.
You did?
Oh yeah.
Did you ask for it?
Yes, I did. I was 8.
You didn't want to play piano?
No. I ended up playing piano later. And I wish I had done it earlier and stuck with it, but there's a story behind that too. But my mom had.
How old were you when you got that guitar?
8.
8.
Yeah, I got it at Christmas.
It's acoustic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
$13 from Montgomery Ward.
Sweet.
What was I going to tell you?
I don't know.
I don't either.
What was the impetus? What was the, why did you want that guitar? The Beatles
on Sullivan or something? No, the Beatles hadn't really happened.
Oh, wow.
At that point. And what ended up happening, I remember now, is my mom had these, she had these big volumes of folk songs.
Right.
These books full of folk songs that had all the little chord diagrams. You know, and there were records around. At this point, her baby sister, Celia, was there were records around from the Kingston Trio,
right,
you know,
right,
the whole folky thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so I was checking that out and figured out how to play the guitar from reading these folk song books and listening to my mom sing some of these songs. So I knew how the melodies went, how the songs went, and I just put the whole guitar thing together myself.
Wow.
And then later on, and my older brother George was an electronics whiz, and he had all these Heathkit radios and stuff that he built, and they were downstairs in the basement, and there were antennas on top of the house, that kind of thing. And yeah, I would sneak down and turn on his radios and tune around with the headphones on, and that's when I discovered rock and roll. And the house was full of mostly of like big band, opera and classical music, and rock and roll was kind of like looked down upon.
Right, and I'm sure it wasn't really too prevalent on the radio there, right? You had to get in your brother's like shortwave or something like that.
I think at that point AM radio was pretty much happening,
yeah.
and there were big stations down along the border, which actually you could hear there, and also WLS in Chicago, KOMA in Oklahoma City, all that stuff was starting to happen, and I discovered it there. You know. Undercover, under the phones, and I'm just like, whoa, you know.
Yeah.
So the next thing I know, I'm like checking out Bob Dylan and getting into that thing.
Yeah. How did you, when you say you checked it out? Because this is an interesting thing, because then there was no internet, there was no closeness in the world. You were stuck in Wellington.
Mm-hmm.
Like, did you have to go to Amarillo? Like on the weekends, you'd be like, oh, Mom, can I go to the record store? And then how did you find it?
That was at the drugstore. The singles, they'd sell them at the drugstore.
Oh, awesome.
There were
in
two
drugstores.
In Wellington. Yeah. You know, I mean, they wanted to make money.
Sure.
And you could get black diamond guitar strings at the drugstore.
That's wild.
Yeah. So, you know, the whole thing just kind of seeped into my consciousness undercover, you know. And then finally, I just started playing that stuff. So I'm playing it around the house, you know. And I remember buying The Birds, 8 Miles High, you know, all that stuff started to happen. And because of my brother's radios, I was able to, you know, to start plugging into it. The first song I ever did in public, I was 11, and I did Mr. Tambourine Man at the school talent show.
Awesome. How did you do?
Oh, I rocked.
Did girls come up and say, hey, did that open a whole new world for you? Sorry, Lori.
Not so much. I mean, it opened up a whole new world for me. But for me,
like new friends and shit. I mean, people were coming up to you and saying stuff as opposed to you having to go. You know what I mean?
It validated me to a certain point.
Yeah.
And the more I did it, the more it did that.
Right.
And living in a town like that, a little skinny artistic kid.
Yeah.
You know, amongst a bunch of farm and ranch boys and football kids. You know, it eventually kept me from getting my ass whipped.
Yeah. Yeah. I bet.
Yeah.
It's always a good saving grace. And so did you start a band? Did you have a band like in high
school? Yeah, we had a band.
What was that like?
It was great.
Cool. Yeah?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's like a couple of us could play.
Yeah, yeah. That's always
you know, the drummer was always the problem. And I ended up playing drums for a while in the jazz band. And I used to say that I was the best drummer in town. There were two of us. You know, but there was a predecessor. There was a girl named Sharon Daves who was fantastic, but she was, you know, 3 or 4 years older than me, so I never really got to play with her.
Do you remember your band name?
Did you have a good name? No, we had terrible names. I can't remember. And we would write these instrumental songs and name them silly things like Spider, you know, just
anything right
off the top of our head, and
any
chord progression would work, you know, as long as it was weird.
Right.
We would run with that. But we used to set up on my parents' porch and give concerts.
Oh, that's good.
And people would drive around, because there was nothing to do in Wellington but drive around. So they would drive over, they could hear you all over the town. You know, I mean, the town was only 1 mile square.
Right, right, right.
So everybody knew we were playing, and they'd just come park their cars in front of the house and watch our show. And, you know, we'd play the 8 songs that we knew. And,
right. And maybe a couple of times.
Yeah. And they'd split, you know.
That's awesome.
It was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how long before you split? You went to Lubbock from there, right? Was it because of school or something?
Well,
did you fail?
Ostensibly,
going to
it was was about school, but really it was just to get out of there.
Right.
You know, all of us, we fantasize about the day that we could leave that place, and the day after we graduated from high school
was that day.
Was that day? I remember to this day. I can see my mother standing on the porch of that house, waving goodbye and crying. As we drove away in Ted McLean's 58 Chevy.
And headed to Lubbock.
And headed to Lubbock, the big city, where they had one-way streets, man.
That's crazy.
You know, that was, we didn't know what to do.
Yeah. So did you play there?
I was really exploring songs and playing the acoustic guitar and singing, and I really wanted to be a singer-songwriter, and I was trying to figure out how to do that. But it was also in the height of the hippie days. Right. So we were involved in other
activities. Hippie things. Yeah. Like too stoned to get up and go get a gig.
Yeah, I used to tell people, you know, I used to tell people, yeah, I was enrolled at Texas Tech. I rolled out of bed about noon and rolled a big joint.
Yeah.
You know, rolled over and grabbed my guitar and played guitar, you know, for a couple of hours and then ate something. And then we'd have a big party and we'd all drop acid and play music all night.
So you were practicing in some way.
Yeah.
You were kind of working towards a goal in some stupor.
Yeah. I remember back in those days, look, fall of 71, about 10 blocks away was a little, kind of a little hippie shopping complex, you know, with
like
a head.
Like an outside market and stuff where you could trade something for.
Well, no, there were actual businesses, but there was a head shop, you know, other kind of alternative culture related businesses and a little coffee house called Aunt Maudie's Fun Garden. And actually, I talked to those guys about doing a gig, went in an audition for them, and one of them said, well, you know, you play real good, but we don't really like your voice. But
did they really?
But yeah, they did. But I was in there one night, and I befriended those guys because I thought it was cool. I went in there one night, and there was this really wacky band in there, with a guy with a real kind of high-pitched voice and another guy that had a little more rock and roll attitude but was still kind of a country guy, and a guy that played the saw and another guy that wrote really cool songs. And it was the Flatlanders.
Yeah.
It was Jimmy and Butch and Joe and Steve Weston.
Did you meet them then?
I did meet them then, and I bumped into them off and on over the years. Joe more than anybody.
Right. And then you moved from there to Colorado?
Yeah, and I moved down here for a summer in 72, but I didn't really know anyone. I came down here, and I stayed with my aunt and uncle for a while. They were living here, and he was like running the tire department in a Kmart. Uncle Ben, the guy and but I didn't know anybody. Didn't really make any friends, and I'd been involved in that whole counterculture thing that we were talking about in Lubbock. And
what was that like? Was there like a lot of heat? I mean, there's the times when you would have like long hair and people would pull you over, and like, you know, people were eating their joints and all, you know, whatever.
Well,
I've
watched one of my best friends get pulled over in the alley behind the Baptist church over on University, and he had a pound of pot in the back of his car, and he went to jail. You know, I saw it happen.
Did it freak you out? I mean,
well, yeah, kind of, because he just left my house. So, you know, there was all that stuff. There was really a pretty extensive counterculture scene
in Lubbock.
Yeah,
it seems like it is because of, you know, just from knowing that the Flatlanders came from there, you know, at that time.
Yeah.
It must have been a little weird. It must have been some.
Yeah, you know, the culture that we grew up in, it was pretty polarized. You had your goat ropers and your freaks.
Right.
You know, and I certainly was not roping goats.
Right.
You know, and there was that friction, you know, always growing up.
Right.
You know, I remember in Wellington walking up to the dance on a Saturday night with a little peace sign around my neck, and this redneck guy walking up to me and just ripping it off of my neck, throwing it on the ground and laughing.
Yeah.
You know, there was that stuff going on. But by the same token, I remember going to the Cotton Club in Lubbock that Tommy Hancock had. Uh-huh. And there'd be cowboys in there. There'd be hippies in there, you know.
coexisting. Like they were in Austin at that time, right? Yeah, Wasn't there like some kind of movement where
absolutely
it was like the hippies and the rednecks?
And it was, you know, the thing in Austin was more prevalent. I think it was just more progressive, but there were elements of it in Lubbock. But, you know, it was more of an agricultural community there in Lubbock too. So, you know, more conservative, traditional values. Yeah.
What if, Lori, when you started playing, did you move to Colorado and started playing?
I started playing in Houston.
In Houston?
Yeah.
Playing
early 70s, studio work.
Okay.
And it was all because of my mom. She was producing movies at the time and looking for music for the movies, and she usually would give me a shot at whatever she was doing.
And she was doing a movie you sang on?
She was doing a movie.
Space Tech movie?
Yeah, called Ginger in the Morning, and it was with guy named Monty Markham and Sissy Spacek. It was one of her first movies. And I think they were in New Mexico. They made it in New Mexico, and they needed movie music. So she put me in the studio, and I had written about 3 or 4 songs, really bad songs.
Was it one of your songs that was in
it? No, my songs didn't make it into the movie, but I got a shot at it anyway. I got a shot at recording them in the studio.
Yeah.
And I still have the little reels that they're on. So
that's cool.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
To work with studio musicians way back then.
Yeah. And that was before you moved to California?
Or
you moved back to Houston?
That was after California. Moved back to Houston for a little while. Yeah.
And then what took you to Colorado?
When my mom died, she was hit by a drunk driver.
Right,
and she died. And
how old were you then?
23.
Okay.
And my sister, I was 23. My sister.
So she was a relatively young mom. She was like 45 or something.
Yeah,
right?
She was about 45. And we all kind of were uprooted. Robin, my sister who's 2 years younger than me, dropped out of Southwest Texas and went up to Colorado to be a ski bum, and I ended up following her up there pretty much.
That's how you
I always sort of followed Robin around my whole life.
Yeah.
So I followed her up to Colorado, and she landed in Vail. I landed in Boulder, and I stayed in Boulder until 99 when I came down here with him.
So you were in a band called Fornication?
Close.
What a great name.
The legendary Fornicators.
I just hear the word and I'm just
I know,
it.
Of course. When we played political events, we had to be.
Humping.
We used to have to call ourselves the legendary Nicators when we played politically correct events.
Right,
but
right.
It was the number 4 and then Nicators.
Right, right.
You know, play on words. But yeah.
It's in there. You played with them for a decade.
About 14 years.
14 years, yeah. Over a decade.
Yeah.
And so what was it? Was a show band?
No, it was like a grungy, really kind of mediocre garage band that played dance cover songs, 50s and 60s stuff, and was rude to the audience, really, really rude to the audience. Stuff like, fuck you, you paid your $5, you know, we don't care what you think, you
That's
know.
That's awesome.
And we'd get them down on their backs on the floor with their legs up in the air. We'd do skin-to-win twist contests and have them stripping, and we'd... There was so much of a legend behind this band and so many crazy stories. Like this one guy, the saxophone player, one night at the Blue Note in Boulder, up on stage with nothing on but his saxophone. Things like that.
Yeah.
This band just had a reputation.
And did you join that band, or you were one of the starters?
I joined it.
I
wasn't a starter. I always wanted to be in that band.
Right.
I had a secret desire. And it wasn't that secret either. I would tell anybody. If I could pick a band to be in, it would be the legendary Fornicators. And sure enough, I got my chance, and we sort of melded right away.
Yeah.
And so 14 years later, I had to leave. I never would have left that band, I don't think. As silly as it was, and we traveled all over. We traveled outside the country. We played for...
So you made a living doing it.
Yeah.
I
made
that
a
band.
Really good living in that band.
Sounds like a predecessor to a band that a friend of mine played in. Do you know the band, the Dan Band from Los Angeles?
Uh-uh.
They're in movies. They're, there's kind of like a show band like that that's very... A
couple of these guys were in a band called Flash Cadillac. And they were like the Sha-na-na type band.
Right.
And
Pretty successful.
They had a record deal. They spent a lot of time out in L.A., but when they retired from it, one of them was a lawyer and one of them worked for Ball Aerospace.
Right.
And they just kind of wanted to get serious about their lives a little bit, so the Fornicators was a sideline for them.
It was supposed to be a one-off gig,
Candy Givens of Zephyr. which was...
That was the name of my first band, which I thought it was weird. I was like, what?
Yeah, Zephyr had a deal on Warner's.
Oh, it's a good thing we didn't know that in the Woodlands. The early 80s.
There's a lot of history to that band. I mean,
Zephyr?
Zephyr, and then the offshoot of it. Zephyr and Flash Cadillac being offshot into the Fornicators and where they went from there.
So you guys met there in that scene in sort of like a mid-70s Colorado.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like Firefall.
Yeah.
Poco.
Yeah.
Fucking the whole
Still, thing. Steven Stills, Joe Walsh, all those people lived there. I went up there in 73 when I realized that my family moved up there in 73 and I quickly realized the crux of my support. Took my last $20 and bought some gas and my one the drinking law in Texas changed for a little while. You could be 18 and buy beer. So I bought my first legal six pack and
took off
and headed for with the change from my 20 and headed for Boulder. And
so did you start playing when you got up there? Were you playing when you got up there too, Lori? Did it take you a little while to get it?
It took about 2 or 3 years for me.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
were you both playing by the mid-70s, I guess.
Yeah, it was an on and off kind of struggle. And then when I got there, I ended up getting a job at a ski factory. But what ended up happening, there was a guy named Michael Wiebold that worked at the ski factory, and he was a drummer. And then there was this other guy named Dallas Shue working there, who is now the guitar tech
for
U2. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
it's weird.
So
he was Mark's guitar tech too at one point, wasn't
he?
Yeah. Yeah.
He was Firefall's guitar tech. That guy's incredible. He knows you need a drink of water before you do.
Well, I don't want to go off into some tech thing, but like, I mean, even in that movie that guy made about the three guitar players, mm-hmm. about Edge and Jimmy Page, like half of Edge's thing has to do with Dallas.
Yeah.
Like in any kind of documentary about U2 that goes into the Edge and what he does, Dallas is always like
he's
referred to, and he explains a lot of things that I don't think even the Edge, you know, can.
Those guys showed up in Austin back in the 90s, and I talked to Dallas. He said, "Man, come down in the afternoon, you know, and I'll show you around the set, you know." So I go down there, and he says, "Hey, man, let me show you this guitar."
That was Zoo TV, right?
It might have been. I don't remember.
Sorry.
But he said, "Yeah, check out this guitar rig I put together for the Edge." And there's like four AC-30s, you know, and this Bradshaw switching rig, and all these racks and racks of outboard gear. It was kind of like every time they did a song, they would buy whatever piece of gear they used.
And tons of them, too.
And leave it set in that setting.
Yeah, so that he could play the song right.
Right, right. And underneath the stage was a matching switching console.
That Dallas controls
because he watched, got a little peephole under there, and he watches wherever the Edge is at any given time.
Yeah.
And he can make the patch changes if the Edge is not up by his his foot pedals, right? So he shows me this extremely impressive, you know, space age rig, and then he goes, "So hey, dude, tell me about your rig." And I said, "Well, yeah, I got this 50 watt Marshall and a brown face super and one booster pedal, and that's it."
Right. But yeah, that's like don't you always use a tube screamer?
No, I haven't used one. I used one for a while, but now I just use like low wattage tube amps and then turn them up and use a booster.
Yeah.
For the solos.
Yeah. So let's go back. You started this band from the ski factory.
Yeah, Dallas basically Dallas, Michael Wiebold, actually the little drummer guy, walked up to me in the ski factory and said, "So I hear you're a guitar player." And I was this cocky kid from the panhandle. I went, "Yeah, so what?" And he went, "Well, I'm a drummer, so let's jam." And then he introduces me to Dallas, and we all became really close friends.
Yeah.
And Dallas kind of introduced me to the Colorado music scene. And Michael, too. Michael introduced me to James Tuttle.
Yeah,
who was
fabulous engineer.
Yeah,
great dude.
Who was
around.
A pedal steel player at the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was pedal steel player for this band called Navarro.
Yeah,
that Mark Hallman was in, and Robert McEntee, and those guys both went to work for Fogelberg later on, and Carole King, and so through those guys, I met Mark and Robert and Michael Wooten, who
right.
who was drummer, the drummer, guy, right? yeah. who ended up being the drummer for Leftover Salmon, and you know, right. great jam band, and so they kind of brought me into the fold.
That scene there was like a very mellow sort of like almost like the name of this style of music is not meant to be insulting, but like kind of the prototype for yacht rock. You
yacht
know what I
rock.
Mean? Yeah, like that, you know, the smooth kind of like harmonies and like good
yeah.
songs, but like, you know, tonight I'm gonna break, something that you'd listen to on your houseboat in Sausalito in like
yeah.
1976.
Yeah, there was a lot of real sweet stuff happening.
But I mean, that was the scene there. It wasn't like a punk scene or like a hard rock scene. It was definitely like a smoother kind of...
In the 70s.
Yeah, in the 70s.
Yeah, but towards the end of the 70s, into the 80s, there started to be a punk scene and a new wave scene.
Right,
it
right.
It happened at this club called the Blue Note. But everybody played at the Blue Note. We played at
all
the Blue Note.
Kinds of people
did. Yeah.
So did you guys have? Did you guys met?
And, we were in a band once together in the late
70s,
sort of mid to late 70s.
Yeah.
Just
so
a
you guys went
while.
Out when you first met. Did you guys?
Yeah, he was married.
Oh, you? Oh, that's right. You were married.
Yeah.
I've known Brad a long time, since I was a youngster.
I've known you.
But you
since
were married.
You were 14.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
You were married,
I was kind of. Mistakenly married.
He was married, and she was a friend of mine too. Her name is Lori.
Yeah, Lori.
Also, and we got along great.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all did. We all hung out.
I'm glad you all did.
Well, you know, they. I was there for all that. You
well,
know?
Like,
I
yeah.
knew what his life was like, and I knew her, and it was a hippie type community. We all just like a big commune. We all hung out together, and
yeah.
We knew what each other was going through, and I was involved with somebody else at the time who was in Navarro, the bass player.
Right, Rob.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's my son's father.
Right.
And so, you know, it was a big hippie commune type of
situation.
Yeah,
this is the way it goes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there, you know, for me, it's undeniable that there was an attraction, you know, as soon as we met, and it kind of transcended any other attraction that I'd ever experienced.
Right.
Because it was not, you know, I mean, certainly I was attracted to Lori because she's beautiful, but there was something else there that was almost difficult for me to define.
Right.
You know, hadn't been through anything like
right.
that, but there was not, it was, the circumstances were not right for us to, you know, to explore.
Right. And maybe you weren't ready yet either, just in
yeah.
your own minds. You know,
so we hung out. We
yeah.
hung out as friends. We would go for walks together, and we went to a movie together one time, and we just hung out.
Yeah. All right.
Our paths crossed a lot.
So musically, what were you doing? You were
back then. I was a folkie.
Okay.
And I went from a folk duo to a folk trio. I went from a folk trio to my first band. The late 70s, it was called Spoons. And
yeah, I saw that.
A guy who, he's real popular in Colorado, still to this day. His name's Chris Daniels. His band now is Chris Daniels and the Kings. And he's
is he like a, he's still doing a folk
yeah,
kind of thing?
No, he's doing a kind of a, it started to morph from a rock, we were rock.
Uh-huh.
Original folk rock to early Americana rock to singer-songwriter rock stuff to... Little Feet, Huey Lewis-ish kind of music, and then he...
Now, all of a sudden, you went into a different decade. I was still, like, thinking the 70s, and I was like, Little Feet, Huey Lewis, what?
Yeah, yeah, it kind of went into the early 80s
right,
and,
right.
and turned into that kind of music and got a little bit more of an edge to it, and as Boulder did.
Right, right.
It kind of
right.
evolved
right.
in that sort of vein at the time. And I was in that band for about 2 or 3 years, and then... had my son
right.
and dropped out of music for a couple of years and didn't drop back in until the early 80s. And then the 40s.
The landscape changed a lot in that time when you came back into
yeah.
it. When it was a little different. People had synthesizers all of a sudden and like,
yeah,
they
yeah.
were dancing
there
different.
Was Madonna and Blondie and things like that
yeah,
starting
yeah, yeah.
to happen.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
was a whole different thing. And
did you embrace that or did you?
To some degree,
yeah.
you know, I didn't. I embraced the independence of it, and the cockiness of it, and being a pretty young woman at the time, being able to reinvent myself,
mm-hmm.
watching Madonna come onto the scene, and that was back in the beginning for her. But all of our ideas started changing about what we were.
Right.
You know, there were all these male musician things that had happened for a real long time, and now suddenly there were really cool female musician things happening and singers. So, yeah, I loved that.
Yeah. And so you got back into it and stayed in Boulder, and you moved to Austin.
Yeah, about 2 months.
Because there was like a mass migration of you guys.
Yeah, Mark and Robert and all those guys moved down here, and then about 2 months after Lori's son, Adam, I call him my son now because he is.
Oh, he's a good guy.
He's a good guy. Yeah. You know him. Yeah. But after Adam was born in August, and I came down here in October of 81, and I was the only Texan in a whole bunch of that Colorado crew. And just like it had always been, I mean, it was kind of a struggle for me in Colorado, you know, and I hate to say it, but part of it was being a Texan in Colorado. You know, we kind of spoke a different language in a sense.
Sure.
And every time I would come back, I'd get all these gigs. I remember coming back to Lubbock back in 75, and after beating my head against the door in Boulder, you know, for 2 or 3 years, it's like I thought, well, I'm going to go to Lubbock, you know, go home. And went to Lubbock, and boom, I'm working, I'm playing gigs. But I wasn't really plugged into Joe and all those guys, although I knew them, but we weren't really friends at the time. And so I was still kind of on the periphery, and I knew all these great musicians in Boulder, and I went back thinking, well, you know, that's going to rub off on me more, because I was closer to those, to that particular crowd.
Right.
And I was still trying to kind of do the singer-songwriter thing, and I went back to Boulder and tried to do that again and kind of experienced the same thing. It was always a struggle. And in 81, I came down here. Well, actually, before that, finally, I just got to the point where I was kind of tired of starving. And for about 2 years, I played the guitar all day, every day, for 2 years. Studied, worked real hard at developing a real guitar technique, and started hiring myself out. I got to become accomplished enough as a musician, not just like a singer-songwriter guy, that people would actually hire me.
Right.
So that started to happen in Colorado a little bit, but not with people that, frankly, that I really wanted to play with. I mean, I played with some guys that were my friends, but musically, I mean, they told me, these guys reconnected with me recently on Facebook and said, you were the first guy we ever worked with that didn't play the wrong notes.
Right.
You know, and I came down here and then boom, it was just a string of gigs.
Yeah.
I was observing all that with you up there because I remember your frustration when we'd sit at Dot's Diner at the counter.
Yeah.
And you'd just talk about how hard it was and how people didn't understand, and it was true they didn't understand. It was like there was this evolution going on down in Texas, in Lubbock and everything that Brad's talking about. He was going through the very same thing as if there was some direct connection with him, but he was up in Colorado, so it was frustrating and confusing.
Right.
I mean, if he'd been down there, it would have just evolved naturally.
Right.
But he's going through it somewhere else.
Right.
And bringing that kind of edge that he had, that cockiness, to a scene that didn't understand it.
Right. Yeah. There's no cocky in like the
Rocky
Mountain High scene.
So it was frustrating, and he didn't know why. But it was just stands to reason that the minute you came back, it just clicked in again.
Yeah. And then, I mean, then it just went from gig to gig to gig, and you were, you're playing multiple, doing the multiple.
Oh, yeah. Playing 5 and 6 bands at a time.
Yeah.
You know, out of necessity. You
of
know,
course.
And thank God the work was there.
Yeah.
You know. So it all just kind of snowballed from there. But I quit singing, you know, because I suddenly realized, you know what, I don't have to sing now because I don't have to advertise that. You know what I mean? Because people are going to hire me to play. They're going to hire me to play. So I didn't even really pursue that. And if I got into a situation that I really liked, if I was playing with people that I liked, then I would kind of let the cat out of the bag and I'd start singing harmonies and doing and that kind of thing. But I didn't stand up and front a band anymore or try to be the guy.
Right. It's exhausting.
Yeah.
It is.
It is.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
It is. That's what this podcast is all about. Should be called, instead of how did I get here, why do I do this?
Right.
So I mean, you went from gig to gig. You ended up, like, when I moved back here, you were playing with Jimmy Dale Gilmore at that time, and
yeah,
you were playing with Ian Matthews, and you were doing a lot of recording.
Yeah, I...
You were doing a lot of different stuff, too, because I remember there was some live Ian Moore thing that I saw you play at.
You know,
Is that a record or something?
Yeah, I did a live... Ian did a live record for Capricorn down at Steamboat.
Right, right, right.
And I was really honored that he called me, because he told me, he said, man, I know that if I need you to stand up there and beat rhythm all night, you'll do just that. Because that's what I need for you to do. He said, I can trust you to do that and not try to showboat. You know?
Yeah.
But the way that he put it was so respectful. I mean, really validated. It was really great. I mean, I had known him since he was about 18, and I had recorded him before, and I really really meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was really cool. And but my whole evolution to all that, I mean, when I came here, I just took every gig that came. I didn't care. People would call them and go, yeah, you play country. I go, oh, yeah. You know, when really I was like I'd come from the folky singer-songwriter place and the rock place. My guitar heroes were like Clapton and Hendrix and right. Jeff Beck and people like that. But, you know, I'd just go, yeah, to anything.
Yeah.
And I'd go learn it on the gig. Hey, you know how to play all the standard country intros and outros? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Get there and like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
But there was a decided shift for me in the mid-80s, because I didn't get into all this to play. I wanted to create. I didn't want to play cover right. stuff. And I made a conscious...
This is the part of the podcast where every guest insults me. But go ahead.
Well, there's nothing...
No.
They always say that too. But there's nothing wrong with
no,
it.
No, wait a minute. No,
I'm only
totally
kidding.
With
I'm just
you
kidding.
Because
I'm just
I do
kidding.
The same thing you do. Yeah. I love it. Love it. Cover stuff.
But I was the guy that... I was the guy that... It didn't matter...
He's a snob.
It didn't matter what amp I showed up with... You know, when I even, and it didn't matter, you know, show up in a suit, you know, but when I pulled out the Fiesta Red Stratocaster and the little amp, they would look at me and think I was too loud. You know, I was
yeah,
there.
Yeah, there's a stance. You have a stance, like a stance, even when you're on stage. Your posture is like, look out, motherfuckers, here it comes. You know what I mean? Like, you have that kind of like a... You know, it's cool.
Well, thanks.
I mean, you got to have that. Or like, why would you, you know, they probably, you know, not that you didn't play well, but I mean, I bet that was a good part of the reason why people would even hire you, because they knew that you would stand up there and be confident and play the right notes.
Right. And yeah, make a statement when it's time to make a statement.
Yeah.
You know,
right,
I mean,
right.
I definitely learned the art of being a sideman, you know, and that is be
knowing when not to play.
Yeah, be supportive when it's time to be supportive, and when it's your time, when it's your time to play, it's your time, and make your statement then.
Yeah,
and then support the artist.
Yeah,
you know, and yeah. I love that. I love doing that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, you're great at it.
Thank you.
Yeah,
you know, what I was gonna say is that in the mid '80s, after doing all those gigs that I did, I finally decided, you know, I don't really want to do this anymore. I want to play in original acts, and I want to be right. making records and doing that whole
moving
thing.
Moving forward.
Yeah, moving
as an
forward.
Artist. Yeah.
And I made that decision, and gradually it just kind of filtered in. And Robert and I were doing a duo, like a rock duo. It was terrible. I mean, we played great, but it was one of those things. It was in the beginnings of the MIDI days, and we had a drum machine and a sequencer.
What was it called?
Radio Therapy.
Yeah, awesome, thank you.
I didn't think of that name, but anyway, but I was happy to be playing, you know.
Radiotherapy.
The funny thing about Radiotherapy is that, you know, we have this sequencer and a couple of keyboards, you know, doing the bass line and the keyboard parts and the drum machine. It's
right,
all
right.
run by this digital device.
Yeah.
We had like 400 watts of guitar.
This is right now. I wish we had a videotape to watch of this. Did you guys play out? You played shows?
Yeah. We
in
played,
this configuration?
We played those terrible Chelsea Street pubs
okay,
and stuff
but
like that.
You didn't go showcase like
no.
two guys as a radio therapy.
No, we didn't do that. We did this to make money while we pursued
your own
other,
thing. Right?
Is that the picture on the wall of shame?
Yeah.
Radiotherapy?
So were you playing covers in Radiotherapy?
Yeah, we were playing covers. Oh, you know, ZZ
Top.
Did I live
here then? Was it after I moved?
It might have been about the time you showed up. It was about the time that I met you.
Okay.
Right around in there, you know, 84, 85, 86. Yeah. Robert had gotten the guitar slot with Eliza Gilkison, and she was looking for a keyboard player. So I went, I'm a keyboard player. Yeah, so I go get a keyboard and go, I'm a keyboard player, because I figured, you know what, man? First of all, if I have the same gig schedule as Robert, then there's not going to be conflicts in us booking this other thing.
Yeah, this won't interrupt radio therapy's progress.
Right, exactly. So lo and behold, I got the gig as a keyboard player, and she gave me one guitar song a night. So I would pack in an entire night's worth of guitar into this one song and one solo.
Right, right.
You know, and thankfully it was like a really rootsy song that her brother wrote called Big Wheel. But that was the point at which the shift happened. All of a sudden I'm working with Eliza and we're doing all these really cool original songs. Yeah. And then, you know, from there, more
were you
original.
Were you in the band that played in, what was the American Idol show back then?
You're trying to get me to tell you about Eliza being on Star Search.
Yeah, were you in the band when she
yeah.
did?
Yeah, I was in that band.
I remember watching it. I don't remember. I mean, I just kind of remember I thought it was cool at that time. I don't even know why I would think it was cool. But
yeah, but back in those days, it's kind of like we were, you know, it's kind of like, yeah.
Well, look,
yeah,
we had to try and do it somehow. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everyone's got to, you know.
Well, the whole thing with them doing that show was they needed money to get the band out to L.A. to showcase for the labels.
Oh, well, there you go. So then you got it.
So, yeah. So we go out there to do, you know, to do Star Search. And we get there and her manager said, well, you know, in case we don't win tomorrow night, all of y'all need to call a friend that you can go stay with.
Right. Yeah.
We were like, what? What? Flim flam, scam. Yeah.
That's the way.
But we won
are.
That night.
You did win.
Yeah.
You and do you remember who you lost to?
I remember
it was
who
Brad
we...
and Robert as radio therapy.
I remember who we beat that night. And the funny thing about that was, you know, when you would do the show, they would fly you in the night before and you would go to a taping and they would take you backstage and introduce you to that night's contestants.
Right.
And then you would go watch the show so you could see how it was all done.
Oh,
right?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So we go back and there's this band from Nashville called Truck. And they were super nice. They were all really, really nice folks. And, you know, we met them, shook hands, and yeah, we're Eliza from Austin, blah, blah, blah.
The band was called Eliza at that time, right?
Yeah, it was called Eliza.
Yeah.
So we meet them, we go watch the show, and they won that night. So the next night, we go walking into the dressing rooms, and there they are, and they're like all wearing their sunglasses inside.
Yeah. LA happened like right away to them.
Oh yeah, LA, and then and then they lost.
Hours.
And then yeah, they were stars for you know, 24
That's
hours.
That's awesome. That is awesome. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to lie. I mean, you know, I'm not on any high horse when I make fun of the name or anything like that, because I was in a band where I wore flowered tights and a top hat. So, like, I'm laughing. I want other people to be as embarrassed of their past as me. So,
right. Well, you've succeeded. So.
Thank you.
But back in those days, you know, it was kind of like you didn't want, it was kind of a stigma.
Well, it's funny. It's funny because I've talked to a couple of people and there was a, there seemed to be this abandon at that time when people didn't care about timelessness in what they were doing. They wanted to do shit that was like right now. So I mean, two guys that really didn't have any business playing along with a sequencer and a drum machine, you know, with their guitar rigs that were probably at that point was probably the only time you didn't plug into a tube amp directly. You probably had some kind of, you know, crazy processor or something, you know,
well,
to get some wacky guitar sounds. But like people weren't really looking, to make timeless sounding music. They wanted to make music that sounded like it was in that moment at that time. And
yeah,
the weirdest
true.
Thing about it is you go back now and you listen to that stuff and it's like, whoa, that's stuck in that. There's nothing timeless about what they were doing
no,
at
yeah.
that time.
Not
at
all.
You know? And I mean, what was your 80s thing? Like after you were into Madonna or whatever, like did you kind of like all of
know,
a sudden
like,
hey, we got to get a drum machine and a backup singers? And
yeah, I did a little bit of that. You know, while I was singing with the Fornicators, I was also doing a duo with a guy who had a lot of electronic stuff.
Yeah.
And that's when I was doing Cyndi Lauper and Madonna and all that kind of music. But the Fornicators, that was my favorite because you were talking about you know, what you're doing and the cover music and Skyrocket and everything, which I love, that's always been my favorite thing to do, is get up there and sing the songs that I used to listen to on the radio when I was getting ready for school in the mornings, like Aretha Franklin and James Brown and the Supremes and stuff. And I still sing that stuff now with Reunion.
Right.
And it's still the most fun that I have. Yeah. It's just abandon for me, is to get up there and relive those fabulous R&B moments and that rock and roll. So that's what I really did in the 80s, was mostly rock and roll and R&B, and I had a blast. And that's cover stuff. It was all cover stuff. So I was
with the duo guy, were you doing original stuff?
More synthesized cover stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, all
like
cover
what?
Stuff.
Like what do you mean synthesized
like,
cover stuff?
Like just whatever was more 80s sounding at the time.
Thompson Twins or whatever. That's the first band that came to mind because they all had weird hair.
Oh, no. Well, I...
And like the token black dude with dreads.
No, for me, it was like the Madonna stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. Elton John, I don't know. But just easy listening.
Sure.
Synthesized music.
And so what did you play like weddings and like you were working all the time? Did you have any other kind of job?
Acting.
In Boulder?
Yeah.
No. I didn't mean all that stuff I said earlier.
About an actress. No, I was doing a lot of TV commercials actually and voiceover work back then.
Oh cool.
A lot of on camera stuff back then. Yeah. And my whole goal was to be able to spend as much time with my kids when I was raising them as possible. So my work was always at night. You know, I'd get a babysitter to come over. They'd go to sleep. I'd go to work.
Right.
So I'd work at night, or I'd go off and do a TV commercial in an afternoon while they were at school or something like that. But just whatever work I could find so that I could raise them. And I was raised them mostly as a single mom and still make enough money to stay afloat.
Yeah.
So that was it.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
It's good that you know, I mean, a lot of times people can't make a living playing music to be able to go out and hustle in the arts and be able to, you know, that's always something to be said, especially raising two kids.
It worked.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It did. They're cool kids.
They are cool kids, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good job.
They're the best.
And if you need a great hairdresser in Austin, Lily at Black Orchid. Just a little plug there.
Yeah, Black Orchid. I forgot that's where she went to go work. With someone else that I knew that worked there too. Chanel.
Yep.
Chanel. Yeah, she's awesome.
So so you guys ended up reconnecting in the 90s?
Yeah.
In the mid-90s?
Yeah.
Were you in Boulder or were you...
I was here. I was here and I'd been playing all these gigs and I'd started, you know, doing a lot of engineering and some production stuff, that kind of thing. But I was playing with Will Sexton and Chris McKay and Charlie Robinson and, you know, and doing all the stuff, and I'd already been through the Jimmy Dale thing. I toured with Jimmy for a few years.
Right, and kind of at the height of his thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, when he was on Elektra, his first record on Elektra, we toured that record for almost 3 years.
Yeah.
It was blowing people's minds that it wasn't 3 months.
And that was a cool configuration, too, because it was like you and it was Jesse, too, right?
Yeah. I remember when Jimmy, it was funny because Jimmy kept calling me up. He had gotten, he had heard about me from his daughter and son-in-law.
Right.
And I was playing with David
from
Halley.
Elise and,
Elise and Dan, Dan Yates. And he would call me up and go, "We need to play together. I want you to play in my band." I go, "Okay, fine." You know? "Okay, I'll call you later."
Yeah.
And then I wouldn't hear from him. And this happened like 3 or 4 or 5 times. And then finally, it happens again. And I wanted to go, "Hey, dude, you know?
Yeah.
Come on, man." And he goes, "I really want you to play with me." I went, "Okay." He goes, "Meet me at the Broken Spoke Thursday night." It's like Tuesday.
Yeah.
Thursday night at 7, you know, and I go down, I show up at the Broken Spoke with a Strat and a 50-watt Marshall.
Oh, yeah. That's not what they were looking for.
No, but so I go in there and I do this thing, you know, and I'm dancing around this whole like country blues kind of thing he was doing with a full band, you know. And at the end of it, I said, "Hey, man," I said, "I'm a rock guy, you know. I kind of don't understand why you want me to do this. I'm a rock guy." And he said, "I know. I love taking rock guys and making them play country." you know, but when we toured, he called me up and he said, well, we're going to go do this tour and it's going to be you and me and Jesse Taylor. And I'm thinking, three acoustic guitars. I mean, what is this?
Yeah.
You know, the idea of it was a little cockeyed to me. And, but it worked.
Yeah.
It worked great because our styles,
right.
Jesse was like this muscular,
yeah,
garage blues rock virtuoso.
Right. He's the kind of guy that replaces the knobs on his guitars with dice.
Exactly. And I remember the first time I met him, I met Jesse in Denver in 1980. James Tuttle was touring with Ely and doing front of house sound for Ely.
Right.
And so I went down to Denver to meet him at their hotel. And I'm outside the hotel talking to James, and up walks this guy.
He's like a greaser.
Yeah, he had slicked back hair.
So cool.
He looked like a boxer, and I'm sure his nose had been, in fact, he was a boxer, and I'm sure his nose had been broken a couple of times. And he comes walking up, and he looked really rough. You know, I'm thinking, who the hell is this guy? And James goes, hey, Brad, I want to introduce you to my friend. He plays guitar for Joe. And I turn around, and then he's got like tattoos and he's all muscled up, and he's got the wife beater on, you know, and all this. And James goes, hey, Bradley, this is Jesse Taylor. And Jesse turns around to me and goes, hi, I'm Jesse.
Yeah.
Check out my new tattoo. I just got it. And he was the sweetest guy in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and it just totally blew my you know, my stereotypical conception of who somebody that looked like that really was. And then, you know, years later.
So you were a fan too of his after you saw him play for us. It must have been good to get to play with somebody that you know what I mean?
He was the consummate showman. Even the thing about Jesse is even if he played things that you could, if you analyzed it musically and went, you know, you really shouldn't be playing a dominant seven in this song when it's so pretty and based on this major seven thing, it did not matter, because every time he played with such heart and conviction that everyone went out of their minds.
Yeah, he was very cool the way he played, you know, all of his, you know. Yeah, I like that guy. So you got a lot out of that.
Oh, yeah.
And you guys must have had a good time kind of being in that position together.
Yeah, every night we would play and Jesse would be drenched in sweat. Yeah, he would just like his entire, every bit of clothing on his body was soaking wet. And he would walk up to me every night. He'd have his guitar in one hand and he'd come up and he would just grab me and give me this great big bear hug. And he'd say, another night, another slaughter. We killed him, Bradley. I love you, man. And it, you know, and it was, I mean, I'm kind of.
No, it's fucking, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's a good guy. That's a good experience to get to have. I mean, as a musician, to get to share that, you know.
Yeah.
That time with someone.
Yeah, it was great. It was truly great.
Yeah. So wait a minute. We were going back to how you guys met.
Oh, yeah.
Reconnected.
I was playing with all these people, and it was mid-90s, and I had been working out of the Congress House for years, but I realized that it was time to be more autonomous.
Right.
You know?
Because, your own.
Yeah, to do my own thing, because, you know, Mark was doing his production thing there, his engineering thing, and he was turning me on to projects that he didn't have time to do or didn't want to do.
Right.
You know, so I was doing all that stuff for him, but I was getting better and better at all that. And I realized that, you know, Dodge City was kind of not big enough for the two of us.
Well, yeah, I mean, just one studio for two engineers is kind of a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was making the transition from being an engineer to a producer, because I realized I'd engineered all these sessions and people would show up to do these projects and there would be nobody driving the bus, man, and it would come down to me.
Right.
But I wouldn't get credit for it.
Right.
You know? And so finally, I just kind of went, I'm a producer.
Right.
You know? And if you work with me, this is what I'm bringing to the table. And so all that started to change. But what happened then was, I was living in a little apartment in Clarksville, and I hadn't seen Lori or talked to Lori in 10 years. And when we had last seen each other, in 1986. I'd gone to Boulder, and it was when I was playing with Eliza. And my dad was remarrying. And I went up for the wedding, and our mutual friend, Joey Conway, who's a keyboardist up in Boulder, told me, he said, man, you should check in with Lori. So I called Lori, and we got together for maybe 45 minutes on a walk. And she gave me this 8x10 glossy headshot of her that she used to get acting gigs. And I took this photo, and I thought, well, that's interesting. And she looked like $1 million, you know. And it ended up in my desk. So I moved my office out of the Congress House, empty out my desk, and I move into this apartment, and I start, you know, just doing everything out of there. And one day I found that picture, and I was single at the time. And I call up Joseph Conway, and I said, hey, man, would you ask Lori if it's okay if I call her? Because I just want to, you know, check in and see how she's doing, you know, and just touch base. And so we're trading messages.
Joey and I were in a band. We were both in the Fornicators.
Right.
So I get this message from Joey, and it's all garbled. It was in the day of, you know, where answering devices had little tapes, right? And the message kind of went like, garble, 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 garble. Lori's number is 474, blah, 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 garble, garble, garble. And the only thing that came out was Lori's number. So I call it, and I get Lori's answering machine, and I just said, hi, you know, it's Bradley, and, you know, just wanted to call and say hi and see how you're doing and, you know, give me a shout sometime. And then couple weeks go by and I don't hear from her, and I'm thinking, well, you know, you know, what do you expect, man? You know, talk to somebody for 10 years.
Right. Yeah, what's she gonna do,
you know? And so one morning I get up and I go and I make my cappuccino, and I walking over to the computer to check my email, and the phone rings, and it's like 9 o'clock in the morning, and we've probably spent enough time together that o'clock in the morning is I'm like, you know, I'm kind of in between you know, sleep and reality, and the phone rings, and it's Lori out of the blue, you know, and oh my God, it's Lori Singer, and this is great. So we're talking, and
I left you a message, actually.
You did?
Yeah. You didn't answer when I called you back. You called me, left me a message, and I called back and left you a message.
Ah.
Yeah. So we traded messages.
So we finally talked, and it took us about maybe 3 minutes to establish that we were both single.
All right.
And maybe we could have the date that we never could have before. And so we talked on the phone. We decided we would do that.
Would you guys meet like halfway or something?
No, I went to Boulder. My dad was living in Boulder, and of course Lori was up there with her kids, you know.
Right.
So but we talked on the phone, and it was back in before the days of free long distance, you know, so all of a sudden we're having these $400 you know, phone bills, and we traded all these emails. I mean, somewhere there's probably 750 pages or 1,000 pages of emails, you know, of us just talking, you know, and
communicating.
And that was in March, and in June I booked a flight up there and flew up there, and we were going to have a date, and that date lasted for about a week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good.
Yeah. And it was just automatic. It just, you know, everything just made sense and felt so good and natural. And we, you know, we fell in love.
Yeah. So were you guys planning on playing music together then? Or when you moved down here, did it just kind of happen?
I always was planning on it.
You were?
I was always planning on it. I sort of let him know that slowly.
Right.
Because I don't think he was always planning on it.
Right.
Well, the thing for me was I had all these records to make, and I had a studio to support, and it began to snowball, you know, and I had the financial responsibility of all that.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, I mean, that's a tough thing, too, because, I mean, you've continued to keep a studio through a time where people's studios are closing because of things like this, you know.
Yeah. Well, we're extremely fortunate in that regard.
Yeah.
You know, that nobody's banging on the door to get the gear back.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Just it's in by virtue home. It's in our home. Yeah. And it's by virtue of the arrangement that we had from, you know, from the get go. I started the studio with my friend Doc Jones, and you know, and over time it's become mine.
Right.
You know, and is becoming mine.
Yeah.
You know.
So you still produce a lot and do a lot of records. I saw there were some records that you did that were on like the Americana charts and stuff like that with some different artists.
Yeah.
You're still going pretty strong producing a lot of records.
Yeah. Yeah, I still do that. I love doing that. I really like it.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, you know, I mean, when I worked out at Congress House, I was working on 2-inch tape and doing that whole thing, right. Which of course was an really expensive medium.
Yeah.
And the whole digital thing started happening, and I railed against it for years. But then once I finally made a record in Pro Tools, what it did for me is it focused all my talents in one place because I already had Mac computer chops.
Right.
You know, and guitar chops and production chops and, you right. know, that all just came together and
right.
took off from there.
It came together, and now you have a Deep Oasis album.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and you're selling that through your websites.
Yeah.
Do you have a together website? Is it bradleycop.com?
Singerandcop.com.
Mm-hmm. Singerandcop.com. KOPP.
Yeah.
Awesome. You guys have any gigs coming up anytime soon? Good gigs.
We've got some stuff during South by Southwest, and we just did a little string of gigs here recently, and we're working on booking a tour in Holland, hopefully for the fall.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, we'll see. You know, things are tough over there right now.
Yeah.
Economically.
Yeah.
So, you know, fingers crossed that we'll
fingers
be able to
crossed.
Work all that.
Yeah. You guys have like you have to get distribution there? Can you just take your CDs or something?
Well,
or?
you can take your CDs, but we have a distribution deal with a small label over there called In Betweens Records.
Okay.
A guy named Jos Starmans owns that, and he's been real helpful in making all that stuff happen.
Okay. Last night I had some time. I actually played with my band Liars and Saints last night, and I hung out with my friend Lars Gorenson, who's Swedish. I don't know if you know him. He's a producer here in town. But I was telling him how I'd become kind of obsessed over the last few weeks with Scandinavian death metal. And I don't know why. I just missed all of that music. So I'm going back and learning everything about heavy metal that I possibly can. For what reason, I have no idea. But he told me about... like worse or tougher and darker than Scandinavian death metal is Norwegian black metal.
Whoa.
Where dudes actually burn down churches and stuff. They're so satanic.
Oh my
crazy.
God.
Yeah. So, so look out for those guys when you're up there.
Yeah.
Bands like Venom.
Venom. Okay. I don't think we're going to make it that far north.
No.
You never know.
You never know.
Yeah.
So you guys are going to do some stuff at South by, you said?
Yeah.
Do you know what?
One thing we're doing is a showcase, and not legitimate South by Southwest stuff,
right.
Just off South by Southwest, New World Deli.
It's on Guadalupe, right?
Yeah,
yeah, we're going to host tonight.
Oh, cool.
That
and
Thursday.
What night is that? Thursday?
Thursday the 15th.
Who else playing?
And Karen Abrams is playing, and she's a singer-songwriter, great singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
When we were in Holland last, we were over there, toured with her.
Oh, really?
And that was a lot of fun. Yeah.
And she's from there, or she's...
She's from here.
Okay.
And Sugar Bio.
I don't know who that is.
They are... Have you ever heard of Denim?
Nope.
Bill Browder.
Denim. Wait, I have heard of Denim.
Yeah. Denim has been around here for...
I was thinking Venom. Sorry.
Denim's been here for years and years. They had a major record deal in the 70s. They were kind of like the local Crosby, Stills, and Nash
right.
type. You know,
right.
acoustic rock vocal band.
Really talented musicians with great harmonies. And then they have an offshoot cover band called The Big Time.
Oh, excellent.
I do a lot of same stuff that my band Reunion does.
Okay.
Richard Bowden plays with Sugar Bio.
Oh, cool.
And with Karen Abrams.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to all share the night over there.
Cool.
In
so that's a Thursday of South by Southwest.
Yeah.
And then we're
yeah.
doing something on Friday for what's John Conquest's magazine?
Third World.
Third Coast Music.
Okay.
We're doing the Third Coast. And basically that particular day features female singer-songwriters. So I'm going to be there in support of Lori.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to tell me something that I didn't know. Something about you.
No, I'm still the same guy, Johnny.
I handle that side of it.
Well, good.
Well,
Well, Lori and Brad, thank you for coming over.
Thanks, Johnny.
Having this conversation. Now I know even more about you. That's kind of freaky.
That is freaky because you already knew too much about
me. Too much. No, it's way too much information. Well, thank you guys. Get their album, A Deep Oasis, to play some music from it, some more music from it, and I will talk to you soon.
This cowgirl knows when to go. Postcards and cell phones. I long for the.
All right, man. Well, that was fun. It's nice to have Lori and Brad over. It's nice to catch up with Brad. I've known him since I was a kid, as you heard. Thanks again for listening. Here's some more Bradley Kopp and Lori Singer, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
So when